This is the 29th of June, 1976. Gerda and I are interviewing in the Des Moines, Iowa area.
Would you give us your name, sir?
My name is Johannes Knudsen, to put it in the Danish pronunciation. I love the name Johannes in Danish. I hate the name Johannes in English. It sounds so harsh.
And would you give me the name of your mother and your father, your mother's maiden name?
My mother was Tora Wilstrup. She was a minister's daughter from West Jutland in Denmark. My father was Torvald Knudsen, and he was a folk school director and a minister in United States, moved back to Denmark in 1920 and was a folk school director and a minister in Denmark until he died.
Would you give us a little bit more information on your mother, the town she came from? Yes.
The schooling.
The town was Bois in the western part of Jutland, where her father, her grandfather and her great-grandfather had been ministers in unbroken succession in the same village for over 100 years.
Do you know why your mother decided to come to the United States?
Yes, because my father was over here and he came back and married her and took her along over here.
Now, you mentioned your grandfather as well as your great-grandfather and your great-great-grandfather.
Yes.
May we have their names?
Yes, my grandfather was Henrik Wilstrup. His father's name was Klaus Nikolai Wilstrup. And his father, again, I can't remember, I think it was Karl. Yes, Karl.
Did you have the opportunity to meet any of those ancestors of yours?
In 1905, my parents went back to visit my grandfather, and I was less than 3 years old. So I met him, but I cannot remember.
What about your grandmother? Do you remember anything?
My mother's mother died when my mother was 12 years old. My father's mother died when he was a young man. I have never had any acquaintance with my grandmother's. My father's father I have known.
Would you tell us about your father's father?
My father's father was a school teacher. He was very much inspired by Grundtvig and the folk school movement and by Christian Koch. And he started a free school for children and, you might say, an orphanage, although it was not officially so. It was a home for children without a home. And for many years he taught school in near Ringe in Fyn.
I don't know if you know his operation this well of the school, but do you know how he financed the creation of his school and the operation of his school?
It was entirely a private financing. He either bought or inherited a small homestead or farm, very small farm. And he made that into a school, and his income consisted of tuition paid by the parents of the children who went there and gifts, and he lived mostly off the farm. I don't think he ever got much out of tuition. It was private enterprise.
Do you know what his maximum number of students may have been?
No, I don't, but I would guess it was around in the 30s.
Was it co-educational?
Yes, it was children. It was a children's school. Boys and girls.
Boys and girls.
It was a free school, with the main emphasis on storytelling, Bible stories and history, and then, of course, the routine 3 hours.
Have you ever heard or have you ever read any of the stories he told to his charges?
No, because when I knew him, he was quite an old man, but he has written his own autobiography, and I have read that, so I have quite a strong impression of how he lived with him.
Would you give us a characterization of your grandfather?
My grandfather was a very sincere but very quiet man. He never raised his voice, but he had an intense belief in the free school and or Grundtvigian method of oral relationship to the students. And he told them the Bible stories and the stories from the history of Denmark in a low key, but with in a very living and intense way, so that they remembered it all their lives.
You have several times mentioned that your grandfather was more or less Grundtvigian,
yes,
in philosophy. Could you encapsulate some of the philosophy he took from Grundtvig?
The educational philosophy that he was very much inspired by was that the education of children should not be rote learning. There should, of course, be a training in the essentials of reading, writing, arithmetic. But the main educational method is to, if I may say it my way, fire the imagination, stimulate the imagination of the children, make them participate in things worthwhile, particularly through the means of historical teaching, Bible stories and the stories of his own country. There should be as little pressure for memorization or examination as possible, just in order to meet the minimum requirements of what we nowadays would call accreditation by the authorities recognizing this as a school. But the very strong emphasis on personal relations and personal, very personal means of communicating. That was.
You have just related a story to us that dealing with the free school and the perhaps the Grundtvigian theory. Would you repeat that for the tape?
This is a story that's told about the Christian Koch, who started the free schools and the folk schools, and it could very well have applied to my grandfather. Christian Koch believed in telling very vividly these stories, for instance, the Bible stories, and one day he was telling the story of Abraham, who was asked to sacrifice his son Isaac. The lunch bell rang before he could complete the story. During the lunch hour, he saw one of the little girls standing in the garden of the school, and he went toward her, and as he approached her, he heard her say, in a prayer-like tone of voice, "Dear Abraham, please don't be afraid, because I have read the book, and you're not going to lose Isaac after all," which is an evidence of the intense absorption in the story by the child, of course.
Your own father, do you know why he decided to come to America?
Oh, yes. My father was trained as a gardener, went to England for a while to work as a gardener, a landscape gardener. He experienced some kind of religious maturation. I won't say a crisis or conversion, but maturation while he was in England. Came back to the folk school at Asco and had a desire to become a minister. And so they encouraged him to study for the ministry at Asko Folk School in Denmark. They had a three-year program for ministers for America at that time. He went through that program and added 2 years at the University of Copenhagen in free study, and then he was called by the Commission for Danish American Mission to go to Nebraska to become a minister and folk school director. He had met my mother at Asko Folk School, and after he came to Nebraska, having been there 2 years, he went back and married her and brought her over here. And that's the reason why she came.
Did you ever hear if there was any objection to this young woman leaving for a new world?
There was no objection. Her father was a minister. He was lonesome, and he hated to see his only daughter leave his home because she had taken care of him, but he gave them their blessing and felt that this was the call they had to meet. And I have never heard that there was any obstacle placed in their way.
Have you heard any of the stories of their coming across the ocean?
Yes. They were married in 1900. They took the boat to England and sailed, I believe, from Liverpool. We were very poor. His salary as a minister was very small. They spent their honeymoon on a White Star Line steamer. He slept in the dormitory room with 60 men, and she slept in the dormitory room with 60 women. That was their honeymoon. They have told me many times that they, in order to have some time together, they would go to bed early before the majority went to bed, and there was a lot of noise and commotion. And then they would get up early in the morning, long before the rest, and they would spend their time on deck together, talking together.
What were some of the things they brought from Denmark with them?
They did not bring many possessions, mostly books and clothing and silverware. My mother brought some silverware, but they could not, of course, bring any furniture or anything like that. We've inherited very little of that kind.
Yeah. Did they have to bring anything with them that they could use only on the ship?
I'm not sure. I think by the time they traveled in the year 1900, the ship furnished a complete diet. The food wasn't very good, but it was adequate, and there was no illness. The earlier immigrant stories of having to provide their own food and suffering from dysentery and things did not prevail, no. It was rather civilized in 1900.
Where did they enter the United States?
They entered in New York.
Through what port area?
Well, I think it was Ellis Island, but I'm not certain of that. They have never really related an impression of mine. I don't think it was much of an ordeal. My father, when he first came, was met in New York by a pastor who took care of him and shipped him on to Nebraska. He was officially sent out as a minister. He went to Omaha, where he was ordained, so he had no trouble. And when he brought my mother over, he already had 2 years of experience in America. So,
Your father also spoke English before.
My father had spent 2 years in England and was fluent in English.
Did your mother know English?
My mother never learned English very well for two reasons. We lived in Nebraska and in Tyler, Minnesota, where everyone spoke Danish. Secondly, she became very hard of hearing early. Already in 1910, it was hard for her to communicate. And although she read the language very well and could speak it, she seldom did.
You mentioned your father came to Omaha, Nebraska.
Yes.
What church did he serve there?
He served a church at Nystad, Nebraska. But the Danish Evangelical Lutheran Church in America had their annual convention in Omaha, and at that convention he was ordained.
Oh, I see. He did not serve a church
in
Omaha.
He did not serve in Omaha. He served in Nystad, Nebraska.
How big a family did this couple have?
My father and mother had seven boys.
No girls?
Before they, to everybody's surprise and pleasure, had a daughter. A little later on, a second one who died in infancy. My one sister went back to Denmark. She married a man who later on became a bishop, but she died in her 30s from multiple sclerosis. I have six brothers, four of whom are living in this country and three of whom are living in Denmark. Three of us are pastors. One is an engineer, and one's a school teacher, and one's a freelance artist, writer, painter.
You just mentioned the multiple sclerosis. Do you remember any particular illnesses as you grew up in your family?
I remember the children's sickness. We had measles at one time, and I had pneumonia when I was a child, and one of my brothers had diphtheria. During the epidemic in 1918, all of us had the flu. All of us recovered, of course. All the boys have been in good health. When we were boys, there was always one of us going around with either a broken collarbone or a broken arm or a broken leg, because we lived on the prairie. But we had no real illnesses, chronic illnesses.
Did your mother have any particular home remedies when there was illness in the home?
One of her strong remedies was oatmeal soup. She believed that could cure a lot of things. When we had a chest cold, we would have a hot cloth with hot linseed oil or something like that on our chest. Whenever we had a cut, we'd always use peroxide. Peroxide was used by everybody in those days. She believed it jeopardized your health to eat warm cookies. I never knew whether it was because she thought we would get sick from eating warm cookies or if it was to save the cookies. She also said, if you sit on a cold stone, you'll get pneumonia, she said. The way I interpret this is that she remembered a lot of old slogans from her childhood, and she practiced them on her, partly with tongue in her cheek, you know.
Would you give us some more as you remember them? Do you remember any traveling salesmen coming through your areas?
There was a man by the name of Jan Jewell, Jorgen Jewell, and I believe my wife can tell even more detailed stories about him than I can, but he would come to our home and he would go into the kitchen, he would unload a tremendous bag that he carried on his back. And in this were various drawers and compartments in which he carried
lace
and buttons and all kinds of notions for the ladies. And then he would sell these, and then after he had done this, he would start talking about the church and the preachers, and then he would spend a day and a night, because his real concern was not to sell these things, but to be a traveling newspaper of items that concerned people in the church. He was a very interesting man.
Did he actually stay at your parents' home during these visits?
Yes, he would stay overnight.
Was he expected to pay for anything?
Oh, no.
If this was a hospitality.
Everybody was so happy to have him come and they'd debate with him and hear the news and they'd give him meals and buy a few things from him. He was a wandering, not only a newspaper, a wandering religious journal, you might call it, wouldn't you say?
Did he also sell patent medicines?
I doubt it. When the one patent medicine that was popular in my childhood, we never had it in my home, was Dr. Peter's Curico. Have you heard of that? Dr. Peter's Curico was a very popular. Many older people, particularly older people who would never tolerate a drop of liquor in their homes. But to have a couple of spoonfuls of Dr. Peter's Curico at night before you went to bed was a marvelous medicine, and they never realized it was 80% alcohol.
Now, you spoke of your mother, and you spoke of having seven boys. What kind of a house did you live in? Can you sort of take us through the front door and kind of let us visualize?
I grew up in a folk school.
Oh, you grew up in a folk
school? I grew up in a folk school where there were students and kitchen staff and personnel and faculty around from November till midsummer. And we were always in the presence of many people. We had a very large living room, which was usually I won't say filled, but usually occupied by some member of the faculty or students or the personnel talking to my mother or father. My father had a study filled with books, and I would sneak in there sometimes and talk to him. If I may tell one instance of one Sunday afternoon, I came into my father's office. Sunday dinner was an event. Many people ate at the folk school to go into my father's office and talk afterwards. And I came in there one Sunday, and they were all in talk in a hushed tone of voice. And I whispered to one of them, "What's wrong?" And he says, "There's a big ship by the name of Titanic that's just gone down, and many people were killed." Remember that incident. We ate with the students and the faculty in a large dining room. My father presided at one table, my mother at another. I sat usually at my father's table. And he would use me as a Judas goat to discipline some of the students. On one occasion, when I imitated one of the students and ate with my knife, he said in a loud tone of voice so they could all hear, "One does not eat with his knife." I felt terribly mortified, but I realized many years later he was disciplining the student and not me.
Looking back on this time in your life, what influence, what inference have you gotten from this really public childhood?
I think I got an intense interest in and concern in the common life of many people. We would every morning go to morning devotions, and I would very often attend the lectures as I grew up there. We would spend much of our time in the public room with the students, looking at journals and pictures and playing chess and flints and things like that with them. So it was very much a public life. But in retrospect, I would say that we were largely brought up publicly by personnel, by teachers, even by students. We always had a very strong respect for and even fear of our father's opinion, and our mother was very good to us in telling stories and sharing with us. But I really feel a bit of neglect because we really had to use a lot of initiative on our own because we were just part of the public life. When I was confirmed, it was a very large confirmation class. My dad was the minister. I was very much mortified because my dad was in the middle of this and I was part of the ceremony. In the afternoon, my father and mother went out to visit the confirmant. My brother and I, who had been confirmed together, spent the day at home all alone. Nobody paid any attention to us. My father and mother visited everybody else. Nobody came to visit us, and we were there all alone. It was the most dismal day of my childhood that I can remember, my confirmation day, because my father and mother were in the public, and here we were. We weren't alone. My father and mother gave me a hymn book as a confirmation present, and the president of the church council gave me a $5 gold piece, and that was it. And then a lonesome afternoon. So it was a strange mixture of absorption in a family and a public life, and yet some extent a lonesome life.
How much Danish was spoken?
Nothing
but Danish.
I could not speak English until I was almost 10 years old.
Now, what about, was it only speaking? Was there a great deal of reading of Danish material, too?
We had a parochial school with a library of Danish books. I read every book in that little library many times. In fact, I started school when I was 7. My parents did not believe in starting school for your 7. I had read half the library before I started to go to school.
And this was in Danish?
In Danish. I half the library, but I read many books.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I picked up reading by assimilating with the students, and I started reading these books. And by the time I got to school, I'd read any number of books. Simple, childish books, of course, but they were books of adventure, and some of them translations from English, like Robinson Crusoe and Sir Walter Scott and Jules Verne and that kind of thing.
When you then got so out into the world, what was required for you to speak English, Were there ever any incidents that stand out in your mind?
Yes, we moved to Des Moines. My father became president of Grandview College when I was 10 years old. I started public school. By that time, I could speak fairly well, but I had several embarrassing incidents in school where I used a Danish word and the kids laughed. It didn't last very long. They say they put me in third grade when I was 10 years old, but I skipped a couple of grades and caught up pretty quickly.
Was there a great deal of poetry in your home? Was there any emphasis on...
There was a great deal of poetry, in part because my father was a great reader. He would read to the students, and some of that was prose and some of it was poetry. My mother would read poetry to us, and we would sing a lot. And, of course, in that public school, we had a little children's songbook. We sang a great deal, both in the public life. My life has been brought up with singing.
Do you remember any particular child's story? I'm not going to ask you to sing it if you don't want to, but partly what I'm doing is I want to hear your Danish. Now, is there a little poem you could recite for us?
Hist hvor vejen slår en buk ligger der hus så smukt. Væggene lidt skæve står, ruderne er ganske små. Under taget sværl, kvider solen synker og så videre.
Tak.
Was there any instrumental music in your home or at the Falk School?
There was a piano used publicly. And it's one of my great regrets. I never learned much instrumental music. I took 2 years of piano lessons, 2 years of violin lessons, and I played in a band, but I was never any good at playing music. But I regret that I did not learn, in that situation, appreciation for fine music, because there wasn't much opportunity. There was choir singing, there was piano playing, there was an occasional concert, but there was not any real chance to be exposed to the great music of the world. And it's one of my regrets that I have never entered into that world as much as I would like to.
Did your father ever enter into any kind of politics? Even
the answer is yes, but it's as a minister, he could not be too active, but he was intensely a Democrat. And my first acquaintance with politics came in 1908 during the presidential campaign, when I distinctly remember a man asking me out on the sidewalk in front of the Polk School, who are you going to vote for? And they said, well, Father and Harold are going to vote for Brian, but I'm going to vote for Taft because he's fat like I am. My father took the train one day to Brookings to hear Brian speak, and to his great delight and to the delight of several others who were with him, Brian came into the smoking car and sat down beside him and talked to him. And my father took a picture out of his pocket and gave it to Brian and saying, here's a picture of five coming Democrats. We were five boys at that time. I think four of us have remained Democrats. One has defected.
Now, have you yourself ever run for office? I know that in your father's time, this was not often done by a minister, but nowadays, ministers do participate more.
Well, it's so infinitesimal. I was elected moderator of the township meeting in Proviso Township, Illinois.
And that's the extent of your political career.
This year I was a UDOL delegate to the precinct, county, district, and state convention of the Democratic Party. I have had political appointments, but I have never won. Except that one time when I
celebrated in your
Yes, we always celebrate a fastelavns, which is the Danish equivalent of Mardi Gras, with the old custom of knocking the cat out of the barrel, which was done in the gym of the folk school and over here at Grandview College too, and the one who happened to render the decisive blow would be declared king of Fastelavn and would be crowned in the dance in the evening. We danced at the folk school. My father and mother danced with the rest of them. We were not pietists in that sense. You know, the dancing was freely permitted under supervision and orderly circumstances, of course. Another custom which we did observe for a while was the, but it was gradually absorbed by Thanksgiving, was the St. Martin's Eve, where you eat roast goose in remembrance of the geese that betrayed St. Martin when he wanted to elect him bishop on the 10th of November. Another custom was the ancient custom, which has disappeared, of having a bonfire on St. John's Eve, Midsummer Night, 24th of June, with a little fellowship around the bonfire of singing and storytelling and so on. Those were the main festivals. But of course, in Tyler, and I believe in other towns, we would celebrate the 5th of June, which was the Danish national holiday, and there would be speeches and games and things, and we'd celebrate the 4th of July. And in the fall, there would be a harvest festival early in September, not Thanksgiving, but a harvest festival with church service and lectures and games and so on.
Did your parents ever have a chance to return to Denmark?
They went back in 1905. In 1910 to 11, they went back for a whole year, and I spent the whole year going to school in Denmark, in the common school. And then in 1920, they moved back permanently.
And finished out their lives in Denmark?
My father died in rather young, 63. My mother lived to be 92.
Do you know of any of the reasons why they moved back to Denmark?
Oh, yes, very strongly. So the negative reason was that my father had been a folk school director, a very successful one, but in the Danish language. And after World War I, it was very obvious that church life and folk school life would have to move into the English in order to succeed at all. While he was quite competent in English, in fact, he had gone to school at the University of Wisconsin and at Harvard, he visited Booker Washington at Tuskegee, and he traveled all over, he did not feel the natural ability to express himself that he had in Danish. Now, that's the one reason. The other reason is that in 1920, the treaties of World War I ceded back to Denmark part of the territory they had lost to Prussia in 1864. The people in that part started a folk school, and they asked my father to become a director of it. And this had a very strong attraction for him. I think he was hoping to retain some of his children, at least, for the Danish residence, and he succeeded. We were even split, four of us came back to this country and for permanent, and four of them stayed over there permanently.
When you went back, you were old enough to have a dream of Denmark.
Yes, I'd lived a whole year in 1910 to 11. I knew things quite well.
In 1920 up through 1927, how did Denmark live up to that dream?
Oh, extremely well. I spent my first year at Askov Folk School, which had a tremendous faculty at that time. I've never been in the presence of as great an inspirational group of teachers as I had that year, and I got a great deal out of it, and I got many friends, and I was assimilated into the country during that year. Then I went to Copenhagen the next year, and my first year or two were very lonesome. I had a hard time really adjusting to and finding my way in the old tradition, because they don't have much student counseling in those days. So I just find my own way, and I was quite lonesome, discouraging time, but I made up my mind I wasn't going to be licked by it. And I went to school 6 years, and I got a master's degree with a major in history eventually.
Could we ask you, how was that financed? Was there a church subsidy, or did you have to do that yourself?
There is no tuition at the University of Copenhagen. I paid $10 in matriculation fee and $15 examination fee, total of $25, the only money I ever paid the University of Copenhagen for going to school 6 years and getting a degree. My board and room was financed mainly by my father. I earned some money. I earned my room for board for a while, and I had teaching jobs and things like that. My father spent a total of, I figure, about 7,500 kroner on me going to school for 6 years. When I came back to this country, I borrowed the money, sent him a check for 5,000, so I paid most of it back again.
During this time in Denmark, did you form friendships that you have retained through the years?
Yes, I correspond with about 30 to 40 people every Christmas that are strong friends from that time.
So that you are able to keep current on what goes on in Denmark?
Very much, because I've been there five or six times since. I've on two occasions spent many months in Denmark. I get the Danish papers, I get constant letters and books and so on, and I correspond with quite a few people of influence and interest.
I forgot to ask you a little earlier when we were asking more about your parents. Did they ever become American citizens?
No.
They never did.
My father probably got his first papers, and he tells it this way. When I was going to get my final papers, I couldn't find the first papers. Well, I don't think he wanted to find them.
He wanted to remain a Danish citizen.
He wanted to remain a Danish citizen. And when he moved back, he was still... In fact, I had dual citizenship. I went back to Denmark, much to my embarrassment, on a Danish passport. And the first thing I did after I got to be 18 was to go to the American Consulate in Copenhagen and establish my American citizenship, because I didn't want to be a Danish citizen. I wanted to go back. So, although he was very loyal and patriotic in many ways, he never did become a citizen. My mother, of course, therefore not either. I came back to Des Moines in 1927 to teach at Grandview College, and I taught 8 years. We were married the last year I was here, and then I was ordained a pastor, and I spent 4 years in the parish, in a rural parish in Minnesota at ASCO, 3 years at Hartford, Connecticut, where I worked, and also for my PhD degree. I came back to become president of Grandview College for 10 years, continued 2 more years as a dean of the seminary here. Then I moved into Chicago Lutheran School of Theology, which was then at Maywood, where I became dean of graduate studies. And I was a professor of church history and dean of graduate studies until my retirement, practically.
And now that you are retired, where are your special interests? I'm sure you're not just sitting.
Well, my interest right now is I edit a bilingual paper for the Danish Interest Conference, which is a group of former members of the Danish Lutheran Church. I put out a 16-page paper twice a month, half Danish, half English, write editorials and news items and so on. I've been doing some translating of Guntry. Our book will be published this summer. I write articles for magazines. I just had one accepted, I think, for the Journal of Ecumenical Studies and Dialogue and Church History Magazine and Home Magazine. Unfortunately, my hobby is my typewriter. My wife often says, you should have another hobby, your typewriter. I do work in the garden and do a few repairs, but when I follow my inclination, I drift into the typewriter.
Now, Grandview College, as I understand it, is not as closely tied to the church part of the studies as it used to be. Have you any feelings on this?
Grandview College is now a college of the Lutheran Church in America, owned by the Iowa Synod. It is officially a church college. The majority of the students are local. It is a commuting college, much more than anything else. It's a good school, it has a good faculty. Those of us who were connected with its life at the time when it was an expression of a strong fellowship of people with a common national, ethnic, and church background are sometimes a little sad to see that it's somewhat different now. It doesn't mean it isn't a good school, but it's not what it was.